Well, I grew up years and years and years ago watching a TV program that ran for 5 years. It was incredibly popular, so popular, in fact, that there was a movie about it a few years back. And the original creator's son of that series is trying to reboot the whole thing for 2021. So we're talking about this particular thing, the Brady Bunch. I don't know whether you know much about this, but here's a confession. As a 12-year-old, I fell in love with Marcia, the oldest daughter, and I had big posters of her adorning my bedroom wall at home. But it was unrequited love. But anyway, if you know anything about it, it's the last of the idealistic sitcoms. That is, you know, the last of those sort of really sort of naive American family shows. And if you know the theme song, and you probably don't, but it's the story of a lovely lady who is bringing up three very lovely girls. And it's the story of a man named Brady who had four men living all together, but they were all alone. And till the one day when the lady met the fellow and they knew it was more than a hunch that this group would somehow form a family and become the Brady Bunch. So that was the theme song at the start. And what's interesting, when I look back on it now, no one ever spun out in that show in any major way. There were no addictions. There was no mental health issues. There was no affairs. There was no hint of affairs. In fact, even Mr. and Mrs. Brady were widowed. So they'd lost their partners. They weren't separated or divorced. In fact, there was, of all the 117 episodes, not one of them was shot with rain. That was deliberate because they wanted the weather to reflect and mirror the perfect atmosphere of this successfully blended Los Angeles family. It's the last one of those sort of sitcoms, if you ever want to watch it. It's the way life should be in America, all things being equal. Now, when you get to Job chapter 1, and it was read very well for us, but those first five verses, this is the godly version of the Brady Bunch. Proverbs 3 confirms what sort of image it should be. It says, "Honour the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing and your vats will brim with new wine." And the formula goes like this. You make sure you put God in the right place and he's going to give you blessing in your life. And that reward of blessing for putting God in the rightful place, that formula Job nailed, because if you look here, he owns, and this is an agricultural society, okay, so he owns 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys and a large number of servants. And he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. We think this is around about the time of Abraham, so 2,000 years before Christ that we're talking about. But his godliness is unquestionable. He even goes and makes sacrifices in case his kids have done something wrong in between and are out of kilter with God. So he covers the bases on his kids. And I think, really, I don't like camels. They're pretty smelly creatures. But apart from the camels, his lifestyle is very desirable. It's what we might aspire to, you know, the model of a godly, well-run universe. And he has an extremely attractive character. He's got a great lifestyle. He's got a relationship with God. He's the paragon of health and wealth and godliness and wisdom. And he's also blameless, it says in verse 1. That doesn't mean that he's perfect. It just means, or sinless, but he's a thoroughly good man. His whole orientation is towards God in his life. He's not sort of, he has all this wealth and all this stuff, but it doesn't seem to, he's not besotted with it all. And the wisdom that Job possesses is not, you know, what to look for when you're trying to buy donkeys or how to employ the right people to be your servants or even how to run your family or an investment portfolio. The wisdom for him is having a healthy respect of God, for being God. God is central to life. And Wisdom, and this is part of the wisdom part of the Bible, wisdom is not so much having brains, it's having a posture that says, God's God in this world. And Job's life is punctuated by order because of that, because he does recognize God is God. God is in control of his world and ruling justly. That's really, in essence, if you go to Proverbs, that's what wisdom will teach you. That's what Proverbs will teach you about wisdom. But this is all set up for us in the first five verses of Job so that it can get demolished for the rest of the book. It's sort of like, you know, the whole thing is just pulled away from you like, you know, a carpet being pulled up from under you. Leo Tolstoy, when he was a nine-year-old, was convinced that God would help him to fly. So he dove headfirst out of a third-story building, landed and had his first major crisis of faith, I think. Fortunately, he did survive and he went on to write the epic War and Peace. But not everybody lands softly in their Christian life when they put their trust in God. Think for a moment, could you sustain a major hit like Job had experienced? Because I think it hinges on how you sort of, what you expect out of life. I originally came from Melbourne, but a long time ago and well before I needed to be, sanitised to get over the border. But I came from Melbourne, and one of the things that you have in Victoria is you have an expectation that the weather will be like tonight most of the time. That's basically how you think. And then when you get a sunny day, you think, oh, what a great day today. You know, we can go out, it's warm, it's sunny, there's no rain, and so on. So when I moved to South Australia, I realised that even in winter, you could actually have nice sunny blue skies. And this was a novelty to me. I kept waiting for the, you know, for the winter to come, and it was hardly anything. So it's a completely different prevailing weather pattern, isn't it? So you have a Melbourne weather pattern. You expect most the sky to be grey most of the time, for it to be raining, and occasionally you celebrate a good day. In South Australia, in Adelaide, you think most of the time it should be good weather, and occasionally we'll get a nasty day where it rains on our parade. So in a way, your picture of what life is, your prevailing weather pattern, if you like, of your view of life is really, really important in this if you're going to be able to sustain something like Job's hit that he has. The tremendous shock comes that the Christian life really isn't a yellow brick road. The signposts aren't always there, and you slip up and you fall into ditches, and suffering enters life without any logical reason, and life gets messy. And for many of you sitting here, maybe that hasn't happened yet, and I just say to you, just, you know, keep breathing, keep living, it will eventually hit you at some point that, you know, your bubble will burst, something won't be the way that you hoped it would be. We all pray it won't, but the reality is we live in a world that doesn't work properly, and so we can't always work it properly. And when those times happen, we say to ourselves, you know, it shouldn't be like this, Lord. It really shouldn't be like this. And it's the cry of a frustrated faith. And one of the first things that I learnt with my children when they were growing up was when they came home and said, it's not fair, you know, say, you're right, it isn't fair. Because that's what life is like. Life isn't fair sometimes. So always trying to make it right for them. I acknowledge the reality of it. Now, Job raises three really daring and unsettling questions to ask, I think, of a person of faith. Is God a briber? And secondly, is he in control? And then if he is in control, what sort of a God have we hooked up with here? Okay, is God a briber? Is he in control? If he is, what sort of a God is he? So, is God a briber? If you go to the next scene, the picture is in heaven. It's the courts of heaven. There's a throne. God is on the throne. There are servants. running to and fro. And then the accuser enters stage right, and he presents himself before God. And the reason he's doing that is because it's his duty. He's been called, not because he's just sauntered in there. And he is given permission to speak by God. "Now, Mr. Satan, time for a little report. What have you been up to?" And he goes, "Oh, well, you know, I've been just doing my stuff, you know, wandering to and fro across the world." And God says to him, "Yeah, well, have you come across my servant Job in all that?" He goes, yeah, I have come across him. And what God is doing here is God is giving us a key to why Job is about to suffer. It's precisely because he is an exceptionally good man that he is soon going to see things unravel. It's because he does fear God that the challenge gets put out. And that's what God highlights to the accuser. So, you know, it's good to remember sometimes your faith may actually accentuate and lead to things going wrong sometimes for you. Anyway, the accuser replies, and he's wickedly clever. He says, "Yeah, does Job fear you for nothing?" And what he's saying is, it's a slur on Job's character. He's saying, the only reason Job really follows you is because he's got such a good deal with you. Now, it's a little bit like, if you ever saw the music, the movie The Sound of Music, there's an Uncle Max in that movie. He hangs around rich people in Salzburg. And at one point, when he's sitting on the veranda looking out over the lake, he says, "I like rich people. I like the way they live. I like the way I live when I'm with them." And this is what Satan is accusing Job of. He likes the way he lives when he's around God. Job is a user. And even more subtly, what it's saying is God is a briber. If you look at verses 10 and 11, "Haven't you put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks are spread out throughout the land. Haven't you?" You know, this is the same slur that is often, this is the same thing that parents who have been separated sometimes do to buy their devotion of their kids. They give them stuff, they give them money, they give them toys, they give them experiences, and they hope that they can buy their love and devotion through those things. And what Satan is saying is, God, that's what you've done with Job. You've smothered him, and the relationship will evaporate if you just turn that tap off and stop doing it. Take away the toys, he'll curse you to your face. "You see, Your Majesty, your world, it doesn't really work the way you think. And there isn't a believer in sight. Shame about that, isn't it?" And then this very cunning and devious question is put to us, really, because that's where it's going next. Is an unbought devotion and loyalty to God possible for you? Are you in it because of all the things that God gives, because of what God provides? Maybe it's a partner, maybe it's family, friends, maybe it's, you know, this Christian community that you become part of, maybe it's, you know, a nice place to live, a good job, you know. Be very, very wary of any Christian who proposes to you that the main reason that you'll honour God in your life is because of what he gives you, what he provides for you materially or relationally in this world. Christianity is not a place to hide from the nasties and a place to shield you from a world that is going out of control. The accuser used that idea to suggest that God was a briber. God is worth serving at the end of the day because he's God. He's Lord of the world. And in your own life, when things go wrong, what does your behaviour reveal? You know, when things don't turn out the way they are, because there are people watching you, particularly people who aren't Christians, and they'll watch you more when things go wrong than they will when things go right. You think that you want to show them how great the Christian life is. Well, you show them how great it is when things go wrong, how you behave and how you react. People need to see that an unbought devotion to God is possible in this world. Now, Horatio Spafford was a successful businessman, and he lost everything in the Chicago fires of 1871. And a couple of years after that, he went with his wife and four daughters across to Europe, to England, for Christmas. He was delayed because he had work, so he sent the girls and his wife ahead of him on the ship, and he took another ship a few days later. But the ship that the girls and the wife were on collided with another vessel, and it was clear that it was dire. And the wife got the daughters up on the deck, and they knelt down and they prayed to be spared. The ship sank within 12 minutes. And a sailor in a lifeboat saw this woman floating on a piece of wood, a wreckage, and grabbed her. She went to England. That was Anna, Spafford's wife. And she telegrammed to Horatio and said, "Saved alone, what shall I do? Saved alone, what shall I do?" She confided in a pastor. She said, "God gave me four daughters. I have no idea why they're gone, but I know someday I'll understand why. Someday." Now, Spafford then, after he got the telegram, jumped on the first ship that he could to get across to England to be with his wife, who was now without the children. And on his way over, 4 days into the voyage, the captain very kindly took him down onto the deck and said, "This is about where the boat went in, where the boat collided and sank. This is where your daughters are." And at that point, Spafford wrote the words, these words, which we now know as a hymn. "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." It's a great hymn. Now, what's he saying? He's saying an unbought devotion to God is possible. It is. So let's go back to our story of Job. When we return to the earth, it's a normal day. The oxen are ploughing and the donkeys are feeding and the family is celebrating, and nobody knows what's about to happen except us, Satan, and God. It's like watching a murder mystery, and you see the murder take place at the start, and you see the murderer, and you know everything that's about to unfold, but everybody else on the stage in the story has no idea how it's going to happen. And that's our position as we move into this next part of Job. And then 500 oxen, 500 donkeys, wham, killed. Servants as well. Lightning strikes the sheep and the goats. They're gone. The bandits come down from the side of the mountain and they take the camels and kill all the servants associated with that. Tornado blows up the valley and knocks down the house in which the family is celebrating and all the children go. Now, I don't know if you've ever had to bear bad news to somebody before, but imagine what this is like. These messengers come like massive shore dumpers. You know, as fast as one is finishing, the other one's coming, you know, are lined up, ready to tell you what else has happened. And what you realise is this is a carefully designed disaster. I mean, this is as ordered as Job's life was. The chaos is as ordered as what his life was before. And we watch Job's life go down the drain. Everything is in ruins. You know, like all of it, all his cattle, all his children, and then it says in chapter 2, verse 7, all his body from head to toe. I don't know whether you've ever met people like this. You know, they start talking to you and think, "Oh, so that happened to you. Oh, and then that. That happened? All in 1 year." You know, it's like they're wrapped in flypaper that attracts catastrophes. And you just think, something's really wrong with that person, you know, to have so many things go wrong. This is what it must feel like here. For Job, find a man whose life is tossed on the rubbish heap. Now, he wouldn't have chosen to be there, but he would have been there by force, because once he got the disease, he's tossed out. And he's at the place where they throw the dung out of the town, and it's a place unfit for human habitation. And he's sitting there with a broken piece of terracotta scraping his itching boils. And Job's wife seems to be the only realist. And she says, for goodness sakes, just curse God and get over with it. Be done with it. Put yourself out of the misery. So he goes from success to rock bottom. He goes from riches to rags, and his faith and his successful life cascade and tumble into ruin through no fault of his own. Now, how's he going to react to all this? Well, in verses 20 to 22, we see his reaction. I don't think they just sort of slid off his lips in a happy sort of Colin Buchanan song. He doesn't blame anyone here, but he says, you know, I came into this world with nothing. I leave this world with nothing. You know, the Lord's given, the Lord's taken. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, no one gets blamed here. You notice that? You know, not the bandits, not the weatherman, not the stupid servants, not even Satan. Job still believes that God's in control. He gives and he takes, and he says, there's no such thing as bad forces in this world who are on the ascent one day and then good forces that are winning the next day. For some Christians, they'd have you believe that. They'd say to you that, you know, it's all up to you. It's all up to you. If you don't pray fervently enough, then Satan's going to get the upper hand. Well, Satan is not a sovereign of a rival kingdom. He's a rebel that God gives as much rope as will glorify God's name. Job is not what you call a dualist. He doesn't believe in equal forces of good and bad. If you go back to the courtroom scene, at every point, Satan is under God's control. He has permission to speak. He's limited to what he can do to Job first time round and then on the second time round. Job doesn't do what Satan hopes, which is to curse God. Now, there's an Auschwitz survivor called Harold Kushner. He wrote a book, a bestseller, called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. But I tell you what, the basic premise of the book is that it says, you know, God is really trying his best, but he can't have his, you know, he can't be over everything. It's not his fault if he can't eliminate suffering in the world. He is, after all, not in control of everything. That is just not true when it comes to the Bible and what it tells us about God. It's a common solution that people have who want to believe in God but can't understand what's coming, why things are happening to them or to others. But it's not what Job will allow you to do. He will not let you turn God into a chess player who's reacting to everybody else's moves all the time. So we're never simply in the hands of an accuser. And, you know, you're never going to be just simply at the hands of cancer that's racking your body, or at the mercy of workplace bullies, or, you know, at the ransom of your bad childhood experiences that you had that you can never shake off, or, you know, the stock market, or government policies that are working against you, whatever it is. There's nothing else. Job knew he was always in God's hands. So are you. So am I. To say God is sovereign is to say he's in charge. And that's a tremendous reassurance to know that you're held by God at the end of the day. That's why in Romans 8, verse 38, Paul says to the Christians in that city, he says, nothing can separate us from the love of God. Death, not life, not powers, not principalities, nor things present, nor things to come. And when Jesus stood before Pilate, he echoed that thought. Pilate said to him, look, I could flick this, I could turn your life around in a moment here. I could release you. And Jesus says with a lightning response, you have no power unless God it came to you from above. So you may not always have control over your life, and other people may not may lose control, and God will never, ever lose control of this world and of us. Job passes Satan's test because wisdom isn't based on trying to unravel everything, try and work out the answer to why things are happening. And also, if you do try and do that, it isn't overly that satisfying anyway sometimes, if you try and pin down reasons behind why you're suffering. Wisdom is holding on to God come hell or high water when you don't have solutions. And Job does not reject God as his wife wants him to. Now, here's the last question. If God is in control, that does raise an even more disturbing question, doesn't it? What sort of a God allows godly people to suffer and wicked people to prosper. Have you ever asked that question for yourself? Well, you're not the first. I mean, you go through the Old Testament and people of faith are asking it all over the place. Jeremiah 12, why do the faithless seem to live at ease? Habakkuk 1, why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Psalm 37, I have seen a wicked and a ruthless man flourishing like a luxuriant tree. Why this injustice, Lord? Everything demands that righteousness should be blessed and wickedness should be punished, a la Job 1:1-5. So let's summarise what we've picked up as we open up this book of Job for the next 8 weeks. In chapters 1 and 2, the whole book opens as a dialogue, as a struggle of what it means to have faith. It's a can of worms. And when people ask the big questions in life about why am I suffering and so on, often we turn around and we think apologetics. You know, I'll answer in formula and theory. When the Bible comes up against the big questions, it answers with particulars. It puts up a person to you and tells you a story of what happens to them. And Job could be a person living now. If you take up the challenge to read the book of Job, what you're going to do is trace the struggle of a human being who's holding on to God when everything else gets taken away. Studying Job is like studying the history of civilizations by looking at all the wars and the things that went wrong. I mean, it's not the total picture, but often if you think about it, when people write histories, they often, you know, they erase out, you know, they blot out all the bad stuff that happens and just tell you the victories. So if you find Job a laborious read because it is fairly negative, you're meant to. It's there for good reason. It's 42 chapters. It's a journey with no shortcuts, and you will get sucked into a black hole and feel like you can't get out. And you'll go over, churning over and over and over again, the same ground. You think, I've been here before. We've talked about this already, haven't we? Don't be tempted to read just the beginning and the end. It's a really long, painful process to read the book of Job. And why is it like that? Because that's exactly what suffering's like. You can't speed it up. You can't fast-track it along. The suffering of Job has to get lived through. You can't just do a little cook's tour of it to see the highlights. For Job never, ever sees what we see. Have a look at this diagram. So let's just say, you know, here's what's happening on earth, here's what's happening in heaven. If you just do several clicks, we'll get the scenes that we've just gone through in Job. Just keep going and going and going until the whole thing's filled in. And one more. There you go. So what we normally have is the picture down below. We don't normally get a window into what's happening in heaven. And yet Job gives us that. Job doesn't have it. We have it as the reader, but Job doesn't know what's been going on in heaven and what's been happening between Satan and God over this incident. We get a keyhole into eternity. Think about Jesus dying for you on the cross. Think about how most people see that event that you know who aren't Christians. They've got the picture down here. There's this guy, you know, he was very popular for a while. He must have, you know, he did some miracles. He got a following, but, you know, basically he got it in the neck in the end. No picture of what's transpiring in the heavenly realms about what's going on. That this God has come to earth to work out how to get us back to his. And he's worked out the way that it will happen through dying on the cross. So most people don't have that heavenly picture. They just see the earthly one. Now, that's often our situation, isn't it? Very often we're disappointed with God because we're in Job-like circumstances. You know, we have a tragedy happen to us, a death of someone we love or a loss of a job or whatever, and we sit there and we say, why? Why? I don't understand. It doesn't make any sense to me. And we don't have the full picture. That's why it doesn't make sense to us. When tragedy strikes, we can live in shadows, unaware of what is transpiring in an unseen world. And the drama that Job lives through replicates itself over and over again in human beings' lives. That's why it's a wisdom book. And what will happen here is as you watch Job, he gets angry at points. He gets very frustrated. He expresses a full range of emotions, but what he never does is walk away from God. He always keeps facing God, always keeps communicating, doesn't close up shop. Sometimes, like Job, we're going to be left with nothing but our integrity. Sometimes we're the only ones who believe we have the integrity left. You know, we've been tossed. But we need to hold on to God with a vice-like grip. And you don't have to do that calmly, and you don't have to do that, you know, in a Pollyanna sort of ways. You can do it wrestling. You can do it sometimes angry. But keep that face towards God. That's what Job teaches us. That's real wisdom, a relationship with God that will remain honest, even if you don't have the full picture. Don't close up shop when it gets tough. If you're frustrated with God's actions, keep the relationship going. Be honest. Talk to God about it. The book of Job begins not with human viewpoints, but with God's. And it says, is God a briber who buys our loyalty? Absolutely not, Job says. Is God in control? Job says, always. You're never at the mercy of anything or anyone else. And finally, what sort of a God have you trusted in? Well, the sort of God who gives you the dignity to keep asking to his face why, to express your struggle and frustration, a God who won't leave you to struggle alone. You'll have to leave him. Let's pray. Dear Lord, we know that we've got a picture of what life should be like, believing in you, and that needs purging and cleaning sometimes and a radical retake. Please help us to not just live for blessings and prosperity. Help us to acknowledge you when things are fantastic, when things are really shocking. Help us to know what it means to fear the Lord in either circumstance. Amen.